Good morning, everyone. Welcome to the Roundtable. I'm Sarah LaDuc, in for Joe Donahue. Joe is on a scheduled and earned vacation. Do not fret for him until you hear differently. He'll be out today and next week enjoying some time in the sun with family, and I will be your intrepid fill-in for the days that we're on. We will be off on New Year's Day, but here the rest of next week with news to discuss and panelists giving of their time and expertise as ever. This morning, joined in studio by public policy and communications expert Teresa Bourgeois. Good morning, Teresa. How was your Christmas?
It was lovely and had a magical moment. I went up to the Cohoes Falls at dusk and to see just for a little bit of walk, and sometimes you can see eagles. And there were five soaring eagles, two of them bald eagles. It was just, in fact, there were more, but right in front of me. It was just magical. It's just so beautiful, a reminder of the beauty of nature. And you know, not terribly long ago, there were not many eagles at all, and now they've come back, and it's just magical.
And birds of prey from different subspecies gathering together to hunt the river on the holiday. How lovely.
Indeed, and they were soaring, and they swooped down, grabbed the fish, and then went back to the tree and ate the fish, and then soared around the falls. Grabbed a little Christmas dinner and went back to the tree.
They had a feast of seven fishes. So
they're
not American bald eagles; they're Italian bald eagles.
Anyway, it was a magical moment, reminder of the beauty of nature. So,
thank you for being here as always. We're also joined by Tetherless World Senior Constellation Professor of Computer, Web, and Cognitive Sciences at RPI, Jim Hendler. Good morning, Jim.
Good morning.
How are you?
Good. Although I must say, as I told Sarah earlier, I broke with my traditional December 25th tradition. I didn't go into my office and clean my desks. So,
and I did. I asked you right away because
I
remembered.
I was amazed you remembered. But yeah, I'll try to get there this afternoon.
Well, I hope so. I mean, I don't think the year can end without you cleaning your desk at work.
That's right.
And also in studio this morning, Executive Director of the Legal Aid Society of Northeastern New York, Nick Rangel. Hi, Nick. How was Christmas for you and the pups?
Hi. It was wonderful. We hosted a Christmas dinner at our house for the first time ever.
Oh.
So it was sort of a
lot of
pressure.
You had a lot of to-do lists.
Yeah. And I have two German Shepherd girls, and all the snow has melted, which means we're in a mud season. Mm-hmm. So cleaning the house of the mud season before Christmas dinner was more than I expected.
Yeah. Yes. It is. There is like a level of untidiness that your active
like
dogs
house.
Will bring in, and you're like, this just is a doghouse. It's fine.
And gotta German cool Shepherds, you know, they shed twice a year, but for 6 months each time, right? And like all of a sudden, Calla's fur is just exploding from everywhere. And you're like, what is that? You need that. You need that it's cold out. Keep it on.
If only they could choose. If only you could reason with them about keeping the fur in.
Yeah.
But alas, you cannot. You can join the panel conversation by emailing us panel@wamc.org. Before we move on from the Christmas season, let's discuss Pope Leo's Christmas address yesterday. This in Vatican City, of course, this coverage from the AP. Pope Leo, during his first Christmas Day message on Thursday, urged the faithful to shed indifference in the face of those who have lost everything, such as in Gaza, those who are impoverished, as in Yemen, and the many migrants who cross the Mediterranean Sea and the American continent for a better future. The first United States, the first American pontiff, addressed some 26,000 people from the loggia overlooking St. Peter's Square for the traditional papal Urbi et Orbi address, Latin for to the city and to the world, which serves as a summary of the woes facing the world. While the crowd gathered under a steady downpour during the papal mass inside St. Peter's Basilica, the rain had subsided by the time Leo took a brief tour of the square and urged people to call, he called for justice, peace, and stability in Lebanon, the Palestinian territories, Israel, and Syria, and sent prayers for the tormented people of Ukraine, and peace and consolation for victims of wars, injustice, political instability, religious persecution, and terrorism, citing Sudan, South Sudan, Mali, Burkina Faso, and the Congo. The Pope's address calling for, you know, peace, patience, compassion, really kind of Christian-y Christmas things we're looking for. Let's discuss the Pope's address. Teresa, did you want to start?
Yeah, I thought it was a very powerful, quietly powerful message, and one that's so relevant to what's going on in the world and what our role is in what's going on in the world. And, you know, he talked about the power of empathy and the importance of listening and engaging in dialogue. He says, quote, "There will be peace when our monologues are interrupted and enriched by listening." And he talks about humility, and he also was very specific about, you know, remembering what's going on in Gaza and remembering what's going on in places around the world, but also amongst the homeless in our own country and about those immigrants in detention. And I thought there was a lot there to think about and a message for all of us. I don't know, I just found it very relevant, and that in combination with seeing who he's appointed as the new leader in New York City for the region, who has a similar background of living in South America and working amongst the poor and working with immigrant communities. And I think there might be a sea change in leadership. And I thought it was very, very, very relevant. And I do think that I worry that there's, particularly in Gaza, there's not, it's left the headlines, but people are still living in tents in where rain is washing away what little homes they have, and the food is not getting in the way it should still, but it's out of the headlines, and as is so many of the people. And I think the homelessness issue in this country is about to get very, you know, much, much worse because of the cuts of the Trump administration, and he's just reminding us that we all have a role in addressing that. I thought it was beautiful.
Jim?
You know, I was struck by the fact that the previous couple popes, as I understand it, pulled their Christmas Day addresses more back towards traditional themes, did it completely in, I guess, in Latin or whatever. This pope added an older tradition of actually multiple languages and included some English, some Spanish, which is his native languages and things like that. So again, I think there was a universalist message in this one, a little less focused on going back to traditional hardcore values and a little more towards the whole look to the homeless, look to the poor, look to the suffering around the world, which my understanding is what Christianity was originally founded around.
Nick?
I think that the analysis of the speech is focusing and spending time on how the Pope has trying to balance feedback and criticism of the current administration versus maintaining an eye on the rest of the world and the challenges that the rest of the world are tackling and dealing with. I don't think it's any surprise that the Catholic Pope of any background is particularly interested in protecting immigrants, but this particular Catholic history in the United States has really led the political advocacy around sanctuary laws, sanctuary protections, and then eventually sanctuary cities and states. And so I thought it was I thought it was kind of on brand for a U.S. Pope to kind of speak to that in this particular moment. I also think it's interesting to look at the dynamic or the overlay between U.S. intervention in Nigeria on the name of Christianity, mm-hmm. and the Pope saying, "Please stop violence in everywhere, but particularly in the name of Christianity, and refocus on dialogue and diplomacy." And so you have these two just fundamentally opposite proposals around how to protect Christians. I think it is also interesting that in one sense we're protecting Christians and then in another sense we're going potentially into more violent actions in a country that is almost entirely Christian in Venezuela. So I think those things coming together is really interesting.
There's a lot of stark contrast between much messaging, of course, out there, and then especially emphasized on a holiday like Christmas. Teresa, do you have any more that you wanted to add about it to these two?
I just think what you said, Nick, is so important, and that they really are offering, when you look at the two different messages, very different approaches to what it means to be Christian or Catholic. And I think it really, the Pope's message was a real call to action and call to engagement, I think. And it's just not the time to sit on the sidelines, but call for, and also I think an ecumenical call, as opposed to, when you think within Nigeria, and we'll get to that, but
we will.
Just focused on Christians as opposed to the Muslims that are, you know, suffering also and not recognizing them, as the president did not. And what the Pope is, had a much broader, much more inclusive, not just concerned about the Catholic homeless, but concerned about, you know, everyone. So I thought, and I also thought it was interesting, you know, as you said, Jim, that he spoke in a variety of languages, but he also went out prior to the Mass. He went out and spoke to the people who were outside who couldn't get in, which I think was a very important message, that he paused and he thanked them and prayed with them, and they were standing in the rain. And I thought that gesture was also very symbolic and important, you know, that there was not room for everyone, so he went to them. And I thought that was also a pretty interesting. I'm obviously a big fan of, I think this is a refreshing Pope.
You're
not complaining
on this
Pope. About the prior ones, but I think he's what's needed. It's an important voice that he's obviously going to use his voice very delicately, very artfully, I thought it was worded. But at an important messages at an important time in the world.
It must also mean that a lot of people, a lot of staff at the Vatican have to be on duty for Christmas, but it's probably sort of like an honor.
It's their Super Bowl. People won't like it that people they call like Christmas that. And it's their Super Bowl. I'm a very religious, you know.
I know what you mean.
I say that in the best part. It's one of the major events of the year, so they're all, it's a work day for all of them.
I think anyone who is Catholic working at the Vatican would be very enthusiastic to be working on Christmas.
Yeah,
Christmas
I don't think
Eve.
It's really working. It's
not really
it's,
like
it's
like what you do.
I do
think the subtlety of speaking to the people who couldn't get in at a moment when our federal administration is dividing ourselves away from Europe further in action and in language is likely strategic, in the sense that the Pope doesn't want the Catholic Church to experience this as deep divisions as what's kind of being driven at the, you know, between Europe and the U.S. So I think that's interesting.
Yeah, I really thought that was a very symbolic, profoundly symbolic moment.
Just like real meta, the fact that we're speaking multiple languages after our president declared English our only language, right? I mean, even in that sense, like, he's really providing this depth or this dynamic, that representation of what it can be to be American, and it isn't only represented in the current administration.
Right. And it was just very global and ecumenical messaging, both in words and in symbolism.
Panel at WAMC to participate in the conversation. Our next story relates to everything is interrelated, really. If we don't need to look far to draw comparisons, but we are going to talk about Housing First policies and challenges to that policy in the United States. We will have a news break shortly, but I'll set this up. We'll start and we'll return to it after the news break. This from the New York Times. When the Trump administration announced plans last month to redistribute billions of dollars in homelessness aid, the move capped a conservative attack on the once bipartisan philosophy that has guided federal work for a generation, an approach called Housing First. Housing First provides chronically homeless people long-term subsidized housing and offers, but does not require, treatment for mental illness or addiction. It contrasts with programs that condition help on sobriety or work, which Trump officials want to encourage, though there is less direct research to suggest the efficacy of programs that prioritize treatment before housing. The administration called the policy a permissive approach that has let homelessness rise. Supporters say Housing First was backed by proven science, and few aid policies have been studied as extensively as Housing First. The supporters' faith that it is evidence-based lends the debate special intensity. In seeking new rules to guide $3.9 billion in grants, the administration would sharply limit Housing First and promote treatment-focused alternatives. Two federal lawsuits seek to halt the change, and a judge in December did temporarily block it. Extensive research shows that Housing First places large shares of its clients in housing, and it also appears to have played a major role in cutting homelessness among veterans, which had fallen by more than half. At the same time, Housing First programs have not consistently improved clients' mental or physical health, as the success in finding housing would have predicted. And while Housing First is sometimes called life-saving, evidence does not clearly show it lowers mortality rates, but does, you know, provide a roof over the head of those who then later may still pass. Housing First supporters say homelessness has grown for one reason. Affordable housing has vanished, rents have soared, wages have lagged, and federal housing aid reaches fewer than one in four eligible households. Only a much larger Housing First program, supporters say, would overcome the headwinds of the problems in the economy that spread and proliferate and increase homelessness. Nick, do you want to start?
Well, I've been talking about this for several months because early drafts of the administrative change to the Notice of Funding Opportunities, the NOFO, by HUD, had been circulated over the summer. And so many of the homelessness providers, the providers like Legal Aid Society, which does ongoing rent support for about 23 families in Albany that assists just keeping people housed through the COC here in the Capital Region, and then the dozens of other organizations. We all meet very regularly and we talk about this program, the COC program, and our portion, which is called LARF. I'll try not to get too much in the weeds.
Feel free to get in the weeds. It's helpful.
So for several generations, as noted in the article, the Housing First model really relied on the notion that getting somebody housed and stable was the first step to getting them into addiction services or getting them mental health or physical health support, getting them on benefits that they're entitled to, evaluating whether they have a disability and need other kinds of financial support that they're entitled to by law.
Let's return to this topic after a news break. The panel this morning, Teresa Bourgeois, Jim Hendler, and Nick Rangel. Sorry to set you up and then have to pause you there, Nick. You can join the conversation by emailing us, panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org, and we will return and get into the weeds on this topic after this. Welcome back to the Roundtable panel. I'm Sarah LaDuke, here with Teresa Bourgeois, Jim Hendler, and Nick Rangel, who we needed to interrupt to take care of some station business and bring you the BBC News. Do you know where you were when we left off?
Well, and I've had a moment to reorganize my thoughts on this because, as I said, I've been talking about this for months, and so I was a little like, jump right in. But
which we appreciate.
but the way the program works now is there are COCs across the country that distribute funding from HUD to partners, to homelessness providers of various types, and there's short-term types and longer-term types. And there are programs that focus on families and programs that focus on individuals, veterans, different types, right? And New York and California have the most COC-funded programs in the country. One's around 800 and one's around 900. The third most organizations that work under this program is Florida with less than like 400. And so there's this sort of undercurrent of the shift to focus on a different kind of homelessness prevention back to a temporary support with work requirements that, if allowed to move forward, would redistribute federal funding to states other than New York and California. And so when you scale back and look globally, what is the current split of short-term and long-term funding, which is, I think it's like 70 and 30, and what is the current practice of continuing to fund a program at its previous level at a reliable level of about 80%, those programs in New York and California and everywhere else, they know they're going to get continued funding. They know generally that they'll be able to provide the same kind of housing support. So then those states like New York then fund the building of homelessness shelters, or they fund the creation of units for temporary housing or affordable housing with temporary units. So these things come together with this kind of expectation or this reliance on some stability in that funding program. What HUD is trying to do and what Trump has been talking about doing since he took office is flipping that on its head and flipping from 70-30 to a 30-70, flipping from an 80% reliable continued funding to 20% of your funding being reliably continued into the next year. This is on the backdrop of deep, deep cuts to HUD and HUD programs and HUD funds. Following a shutdown that dramatically slowed or will not pay back certain kinds of housing vouchers. So experts in the field of homelessness and homelessness prevention are both fighting to prevent those new regulations to go into effect, which there is an injunction and they have been rolled back. But the administration has committed to continuing to try to make those changes, whether they have to do it through regulation or they have to do it through statute. And it just makes everything unstable and chaotic. And at this moment, a lot of organizations just feel like the federal government is the agent of chaos. My organization decided to not reapply for its funding under this program because it was tying these new work requirements, 40 hours of work, case management, mental health, or addiction services that somebody has to track for this person and maintain. And some organization has to be able to provide those services to an influx of people that are not currently seeking those services. And anyone who's been trying to get a mental health counselor right now knows that there are not mental health counselors available. They are particularly not available overnight for this influx of new individuals who are demanding some help to achieve this arbitrary 40-hour requirement. So not only would we not be able to supervise that because it isn't available to people right now, but then if they don't achieve that 40 hours, we would be required to cut off their rent assistance, become essentially a person who has created an eviction case for somebody who can't pay rent, which is not sustainable for an organization like mine, and it's not sustainable for many others. And so you're seeing organizations backing out of the program because they know that they can't meet the new requirements. Spark in Schenectady, which is a harm reduction organization, would be precluded under this program from accessing those funds. And so they were also not going to apply. And so then you have the chaos piece is, well, now that NOFO has been rescinded and now they're going back to the drawing board and they're going to try to do the same things but from a different angle. Well, this application's due like yesterday. Right. So how do you then get back into that game? It's impossible.
And without applying for and acquiring that funding, there's a deficit for your organization and Spark?
For a smaller organization, there would be a deficit. I think our organization is large enough that we've really been able to absorb changes at the federal level because the state has invested so much money into housing issues and eviction prevention. But the families that we're currently supporting under that particular HUD grant, we won't be able to support after August, which is very destabilizing for those folks. I mean, the point in time count of homelessness families in Albany doubled last year already, mm-hmm. and now we're looking at potentially exploding numbers.
Panel at WAMC.org to join the conversation. Jim, you don't have to email in. You can just speak into your microphone.
Oh, wow. Hey, I've been typing all the time. Nick was talking. I think the thing that hits me about this is the general feeling of the Trump administration is if there's overwhelming evidence scientifically in one direction and a few people who disagree in another direction, then the issue is up for grabs, right? The notion of evidence-based, the notion of seeing what works, notion of trying experiments. I mean, remember the Supreme Court in overturning the abortion rules said, we think states should be the places that get to explore and test these things, that when there's evidence, you know, that can be found. But then the Trump administration's view, it's far more worth at HHS mm-hmm. than anywhere else, is who cares? We have this overwhelming scientific consensus for X, and we have these couple people who we're going to put in our team who disagree. And they may disagree for decent reasons, but usually the disagreement has as much to do with politics and things like that as anything else. When you look at this Housing First policies, they have been shown to significantly reduce homelessness, as Nick points out, particularly in veterans. It really depends what your goal is. Is your goal to help people and give them stability so that they can help themselves if they want? Or are you going to go with a model that just sort of says, well, we have this way we're going to try, and if it works, you know, it'll look good politically, and if it doesn't work, so what? And I think Nick's right. It's implicitly anti-blue state. It's implicitly... It's feeding into this myth that anyone who doesn't have a job, that can't hold something down, that's having personal problems, that it's their fault. It's the Protestant work ethic. It's a lot of other names for it. But, you know, again, I live in a family where one of the people, my kid, is seriously disabled by... multiple sclerosis, which does not present in the same way as many other things do. They're physically able to sometimes do things, but not other times, things like that. And, you know, the notion of a 40-hour work requirement for their health care would be ridiculous. It would mean that my wife and I go from supporting them mostly to supporting them completely. And my kid's lucky because we could probably afford most of that. But, if we weren't well off and reasonably well off, the old definition of middle class, they'd be out on the street. And under this new policy, not only would they be out on the street, but they wouldn't be eligible for being put somewhere that they could take care of themselves.
Teresa?
Yeah, I think that this is just one, I shouldn't say just, but this is one part of an overall attack on HUD, the Housing and Urban Development budget. You know, this is one anecdotal example of a there's some people approaching it philosophically. I'd say Russ Vogt and J.D. Vance and those folks are real true believers that the federal government should not be involved in these kinds of things. And then I think there's other people who are approaching this from a political point of view, which is, as you both rightly point out, this really will shift funding from California and New York and what people call blue states or Democratic-held states to red states in a big way. And all of this, just like healthcare, what they're doing with healthcare, it's dismantling, but not putting anything in place that's viable, that's practical, that's really nothing. It's a lot of words, but not programs, and also doing it with no transition. Right. There's no interim period to shift from one to the other. It's so abrupt, just like shutting down USAID, right, and totally dismantling it in a matter of days and weeks. And what's the result of that? Hundreds of thousands of people have literally lost their lives, as people have documented, right? And I think the result of this, you think about this, particularly the impact it will have on veterans, So at the same time as they are cutting now, proposing to cut another 30,000 jobs from the VA, which is, I mean, I don't even, that's just unfathomable, right? And they have already cut a lot of jobs. It's another story I heard yesterday where this person, his, you know, three or four people around him were pushed out, and he's supposed to be doing his job and everybody else's and properly serving veterans. It's just, it's not possible. And these are physicians' positions, but there's nurses' positions that aren't being filled. There's caseworker positions that aren't being filled. And the same thing's going to happen with this. And so, you know, we have to call it what it is, which is a dismantling of housing assistance in this country. And it will result in an explosion of homelessness. People will be out on the streets, and then they will talk about, in particular in urban areas, and they will be homeless in rural areas. You just don't see it in the same way you see it in urban areas. And they will be homeless at the same time. They don't have access to health care. They don't have access to mental health. They don't have access to food. And then the Republicans will talk about how, you know, the Democratic-led cities are being mismanaged, right? But then I go back to Pope Leo's message, right? And what is the role for each of us, for all of us? And we can stop this from happening. Five Republican House members can stop this from happening, right? And they can step up and say, no, you can't spend congressional dollars the way you choose, Trump administration. This is a change in policy. You need a change in legislation, right? They could step in. And it's not that there isn't room to improve our housing policy, but this is really just a dismantling. And it's easy to tear things down, harder to build them back up.
Panel at WAMC.org. I'm Sarah LaDuke here with Teresa Bourgeois, Jim Hendler, and Nick Rangel. And we will return with more roundtable panel right after this. Welcome back to the roundtable panel. I'm Sarah LaDuke here with public policy and communications expert Teresa Bourgeois, Tetherless World Senior Constellation Professor of Computer, Web, and Cognitive Sciences at RPI, Jim Hendler, and Executive Director of the Legal Aid Society of Northeastern New York, Nick Rangel. We are speaking about the Trump administration's plans for and supporters' defense of the Housing First policy of coping with, ameliorating, attempting to fix homelessness in the United States. And Florian writes into panel at WAMC.org and says, the social safety net is a mixing board. We don't fix things by moving one slider or moving it back. Housing is an essential need. There are other essential needs, and one's personal circumstances or personal experience being buffeted by external circumstances also impact one's state of being. So that some Housing First clients don't get all the improvements often correlated to housing being provided is not a condemnation of that policy. It just means those people need other assistance. And while some policies in some ways have progressed, they can fail because we don't move other sliders on the mixing board, to continue the metaphor. We don't get anywhere leaving people to fend for stable and safe places to shelter and otherwise demanding more from them on all other fronts. That is from Florian. And Teresa, not Bourgeois, writes in and says, something we do hear often from listeners, the cruelty is the point that attributed to the administration. Nick.
That is so poignant. I do like to remind people that a tremendous percent of people experiencing homelessness have children, and those children are also homeless. And so when we talk about ending homelessness programs, it's not just an adult being impacted, and not to say just an adult, but it's not just an adult being impacted, or it is their whole household. And that can have ripple effects into other facets of that child's life. It impacts their ability to learn. It impacts their ability to break their own cycles of poverty. And so when we're thinking, what does homelessness policy need to look like? It really has to be holistic, and it's not. What I would say about the change in the Housing First model isn't only the transitionary or long-term permanent housing piece. The NOFO also included efforts to target blue cities versus red cities by including language that programs in cities like Albany would be demerited it because the city has sanctuary policies in place. And sanctuary just meaning that the city doesn't spend its own money assisting federal agencies in its law enforcement of immigration policies. It doesn't mean that they're hiding people from the law, right? It just means we have a budgetary priority that is not the same priority as the federal administration. It also punishes cities that have not adopted laws that criminalize outdoor sleeping and homelessness, where some cities like Saratoga have passed laws that say we will arrest you, we will use law enforcement methods, incarceration as a means of moving homeless people, people experiencing homelessness out of those city bounds. It also prioritizes programs that explicitly state that it only identifies binary genders, male, female, which in the state of New York is illegal. Transgender people, gender nonconforming people are protected by the constitution of the state. And so that the language being attached to funding opportunities is itself problematic and is attempting to undermine the rights of states to pass its own laws and to protect its citizens. And so these things are coming together in NOFOs for all of the programs that the federal government is funds. And so each time there's a new grant application, you see similar language because that is the way that the federal government is attempting to undercut the laws of the states that have adopted protections for example, trans kids. And so it is very complicated and it's hard to keep an eye on, but we have to stay focused on, like, where is the money and why is the money changing?
Yeah, and, you know, I'm going to change the subject, it seems, although it's actually parallel, which is, so when the Senate agreed to pass the so-called Big Beautiful Bill, they removed from it a rule that said states could not regulate artificial intelligence on their own. Okay. Later, the administration passed some rules that said federal agencies could control some of the state things within that. So, for example, and this hits environment, this hits a lot of other things. So, for example, if a company wishes to build a power plant to data center to provide AI services in New York State on a federal property, the state is not allowed to ask for an environmental impact statement, cannot say, I'm sorry, this violates our clean air policy, et cetera, et cetera. Then when even that was being challenged in courts, the Trump administration came out with an executive order that explicitly said states are not allowed to regulate AI. So, of course, these things are all going through the courts in parallel and things like that. But it gets down to, you know, clearly Congress moved against this thing. And now the federal government is just saying, the executive is just saying, so what? You know, we don't care what you've passed. We're coming up with different ways around it, or we're putting executive orders out there, and we're just going to count on the Supreme Court to rule on these things.
Well, I think this kind of indicates like some weakness between the executive branch and the legislature, the Congress, because Congress is demonstrating over and over again it's not willing or able to pass legislation that enacts the president's agenda. And so the president is forced to take control through administrative and agency activity. But it does demonstrate that Congress isn't able to actually pass the laws that would move that agenda forward.
Well, yeah, the Republicans in Congress don't have consensus on what these spending bills should be for HUD. Because there is an agreement on all the changes that the Trump administration has proposed. And so that's why you operate under these continuing resolutions. And the Republicans in Congress are not using their authority to uphold the true separations of power. They're not saying, no, you can't just make these changes administratively. These require Congress to act. And so that's a big problem. I do think it's important to say that I hear people who feel frustrated, but they're sort of the working lower middle class who say, well, why, you know, I work, I have to pay for my housing, I have to pay for my health care, I pay for my own food, yet these people just get everything for free. And I understand that there is, you know, you have to acknowledge there is that sense of frustration, right? But the reality is that there are some, you know, many people who have circumstances that don't allow them to work or whatever, and that there aren't the supports. And you need to have built in, you know, not cliffs that you draw, you know, okay, so somebody wants to work, but if they work a little bit, then they lose their child care. And if the, you know, and if they don't have child care, they can't work. The system has to be smoothed out. I'm going to say it's a long way of saying there's room for improvement. But there's no discussion here about trying to improve these programs. This is all about dismantling these programs, design them in the way, just like they're trying to do on healthcare, so that it's unworkable, it caves in on itself, the services aren't delivered because there are not enough people to deliver the services, and then people say, well, see, government doesn't work. You know, they have one person doing five people's jobs, they can't possibly do that, it's not effective, and then they say, see, bureaucracy's no good. And they need to do better.
Panel at WAMC.org is where we hear from Kay, who says, you mentioned earlier about VA cuts. It's so much worse than people think. We had a staffing crisis before DOGE, and it's amplified. Talented people don't want to work for the VA when there is no job security. The goal is to privatize the VA. Spending on community care has grown exponentially, while funding for VA medical centers really hasn't.
Very important letter. Thank you so much. Very important letter, because the goal is to make it not work and then say we have to privatize it. But it was working. Imagine if the goal was to continue the goal of making the VA work. But I have a friend, you know, I had this conversation over the last few days, exact same situation that this person appears to be in, where people around them, they're being forced out. And then it leaves those who are there dedicated to working with far more responsibilities. They can't possibly take care of the patients that they care about so deeply. And it's all, the intent is to privatize.
Panel at WAMC.org. Our panel this morning, Teresa Bourgeois, Jim Hendler, and Nick Rangel. It is time now for news from Sam Simmons. We'll be back with the roundtable panel after this. Welcome back to the Roundtable panel. I'm Sarah LaDuke here with public policy and communications expert Teresa Bourgeois, Tetherless World Senior Constellation Professor of Computer, Web, and Cognitive Sciences at RPI, Jim Hendler, and Executive Director of the Legal Aid Society of Northeastern New York, Nick Rangel. You may participate in the conversation, should you wish to, by emailing us, panel at wamc.org. Let us go to, this was breaking news yesterday, very large story in all media outlets throughout the world this morning. Yesterday, the United States launched a number of strikes in northwestern Nigeria, the latest American military campaign against a non-state adversary. This coverage from the New York Times and the Washington Post. President Trump said in a post on Truth Social that the United States launched a powerful and deadly strike against ISIS terrorist scum in northwest Nigeria, his words, who have been targeting and viciously killing primarily innocent Christians at levels not seen for many, many years and even centuries, end quote. The strike involved more than a dozen Tomahawk cruise missiles fired off a Navy ship in the Gulf of Guinea, hitting insurgents in two ISIS camps in northwest Nigeria's Sokoto state. A U.S. military official who spoke on condition of anonymity, as they are wont to do, said the operation was done in coordination with the Nigerian military. That appears to be true by degrees. Nigeria is a diverse, multi-ethnic country of 230 million people, roughly split, between the mostly Muslim North and the predominantly Christian South. While violence has sometimes targeted Christians, it has also deeply affected Muslims, according to Nigerian and Western analysts. Nigerian Foreign Affairs Minister Yusuf Tagar told Nigerian broadcast Nigerian broadcaster Channels Television that his country provided intelligence to the U.S. for the strikes. In several media interviews after the strikes, he pushed back against the framing of the country's security issues as being about religion. He said it was agreed that statements by the two governments would show clearly that it is a strike against terrorism and that it is not to do with religion, but to do with protecting Nigerians and innocent lives. Tagar spoke at least twice with Marco Rubio. Annalise Bernard, a former State Department advisor who now runs a private consulting firm working in West Africa, said the part of the northwest Nigeria where the strikes took place is primarily affected by violence from bandits. Bernard, who has worked extensively in neighboring Benin, said evidence to support a specific Islamic State cell in that area is dubious at best. She continued, quote, "This feels incredibly reactionary, and it doesn't feel like it will do anything." She said there's very little evidence that targeted airstrikes reduce armed group activity anyway. On Thursday, Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth wrote in a post on social media, "The president was clear last month. The killing of innocent Christians in Nigeria and elsewhere must end. The Department of War is always ready, so ISIS found out tonight on Christmas." Hegseth added, "More to come." Teresa.
So I have to say, I am not an expert in Nigeria. You know, this is one of my proverbial, I want to phone a friend, you know, Fred Hoff, but Fred's not here. So, but I do know enough about Nigeria to know that there's a lot more to this story, that the White House is approaching it with their particular lens that they want to focus on, and the lens needs to be broadened, as you did with the key thing is that this is not just an issue where Christians are being attacked. It's also an issue where Muslims are being attacked. And the White House is focusing on the Christians being attacked, not the Muslims. And that's not telling the whole story. Also, I think we have to pause and understand the symbolism of doing this strike on Christmas, which typically is a time where there's 24 hours of peace. But it seems that they chose to do it at this time, and I think that's disturbing. Also, there was reporting there have been groups who've been urging the White House to do this for many months, but that Trump saw a news coverage on Fox, and I don't think our policy should be driven by Fox News coverage. That's not how we should get our military strategy. And then the other thing to think about is that Trump campaigned on a promise of not getting engaged, in fact, pulling away from various wars beyond our borders. And this is yet another example of where he's doing the opposite. And he's doing it at a time where we're going back to a similar theme as we were talking about before, where many, many, many thousands of experts, 1,200 in one day, have been driven out of the State Department. And recently, within the last week or so, they've recalled close to 30 ambassadors, particularly throughout Africa. And these are subject matter experts. And so these kinds of actions are being taken without the kind of diplomatic experience that I think is needed. And the last thing I'll say is one of the things I think to think about the why here. Just like Venezuela, Nigeria has enormous oil reserves. And Exxon is a major player, Shell, others in Nigeria. And so we have to wonder, when we question what is the Trump administration's real motives in Venezuela, we have to question what are the real motives here. And are those, and it's a question, not a statement, but are those linked in any way to the tremendous oil and gas reserves? I think they have a lot of explaining to do on this, but clearly this is not just a Christian issue. It's a Christian and Muslims who are being persecuted there.
Tim wrote into panel at WAMC.org, must be having a kind of a mind meld with you, Teresa, and he says, guess what Nigeria has? Oil. So an important aspect
enormous amounts of oil.
Any conflict. Jim?
I'm going to take a slightly different path on this because, frankly, I'm not horribly upset when major terrorist groups are attacked. Especially when the country that they're in has asked for help or has aided in the help. And Nigeria has now today said, yes, we did coordinate this with the Trump administration. So that part of it I'm a little less upset about. However, the claim that it's Christians being killed and the turning it into this U.S. framing really I find much more questionable. In fact, I believe the Nigerian government released numbers today of how many people have been killed in terrorist attacks. I believe it's over the past year, over this calendar year. It was over 700 something people, the majority of whom were Muslim. It was 400 something Muslim to 300 something Christian. So it's a group that the Nigerian government does not want there. It does look like there may be ISIS links. It may just be Boko Haram. Either way, that's less what worries me than the fact that it's, or less concerns me than the fact that it's being turned into an American framing that says, oh, we're protecting Christians around the world rather than people. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we would never want to help Muslims. I mean, they're the bad guys, according to the Trump administration. And, I mean, that's crazy. And, again, it's this lack of empathy. It's this lack of believing people are people. And it's putting this stuff into a U.S. framing rather than saying, hey, we're helping a country that requested help to solve a problem they have with terrorism.
I think, share a little bit of context. Nigeria is largely split between like a north and a south, the north being majority Muslim and the south being majority Christian. Mm-hmm. But it is also split by tremendous wealth disparity. Yeah, right. The sure. north being experiencing much higher poverty rates, including what is called the multidimensional poverty incidences, where states in the north are experiencing 90% of the country's multidimensional poverty rates, which includes like lack of access to health, lack of access to education, and also lack of access to farms, food. The north is also where the majority of the farmland is, and the majority of the farmland is owned by Christians. So in the overlap between poverty rates that are majority Muslim and majority in the north, people who are experiencing hunger and severe food shortages, especially after the U.S. withdrew its food aid to Nigeria, the closest source of that food is the farm next door, which happens to be owned by Christians. And so the concept that this is a religious battle as opposed to a battle over literal survival, where a group of people in a country face the most severe shortages of food and the highest rates of hunger, and another group of people own most of the land, have the majority of the wealth, and have the lowest rates of those types of poverty, is where that real story is. And instead of helping the country solve its hunger problem, we exasperate that hunger problem and then say, well, we don't like that now you're trying to take food from somebody else who has it, so we're just going to execute them. Like, that is the solution, the lens that we're bringing in. We're pretending it's a religious righteousness lens, but what it really is it is about forcing people, using violence to solve a problem that food could solve.
Right. And I think one of the questions, Jim, as I was reading last night, and maybe this morning there's more detail on it that I didn't read, but there were questions about where they attacked, was it really ISIS or what it was that they call these bandits?
Right.
And I was listening to the BBC overnight and trying to read some on this, and because I have so little understanding of it, but what their experts were saying is that these are really these internal fighting as opposed to ISIS. And yes, there are, and there are, because there's this vacuum, particularly because USAID pulled out quickly with no warning, there are vacuums and they are being filled in some cases by Russians and others. I'm blanking on the guy's name. They have these like paramilitary forces on behalf of Russia, that it's not Russian forces. And they've come in. And again, a lot of what they're focused on is the resources. And this is a country with a sad history of being exploited for its resources, where there is, as you say, Nick, tremendous poverty. At the same time, there are outside forces coming in and extracting natural gas, oil, and other things, but in a way that's not environmentally conscientious, shall we say, to put it politely. And that has caused a lot of problems. And so the question is, to address these issues, is a airstrike on Christmas the right way for the United States to come in and provide quote-unquote assistance? Is this really the right way? I think it needs to be questioned.
Well, I definitely would agree with you about the timing, the excuses, et cetera. I think to understand just how poor Nigeria is economically across the country, one of my PhD students who was Nigerian did her thesis on looking at lung x-rays, trying to give advice to doctors on whether you were, so it was using AI vision to help identify what was going on in the lung x-ray, did people have cancers, things like that. But she, at her defense, she pointed out the following, that the number of cancer oncology, the people who can read these x-rays, at the Dana-Farber Medical Center in Boston, there are more of them than in the entire country of Nigeria.
In one hospital in the U.S., right.
Yeah, and so, you know, when you start multiplying that by all the different kinds of diseases, all the kinds of different things, it is a country that has been exploited tremendously. Large oil wealth and very little of it getting to the people. I don't know enough about the agriculturals. Situation. Nigeria, I know some other countries that have similar issues where it's also become an international issue. Food security to U.S., where some of our prime suppliers are now primarily being supported by Chinese and in some cases Russian entities. And again, a lot of this is classified, the details, but the but there's a lot of scary stuff in here. And, you know, again, there's a lot that plays out in here. When I said ISIS may be involved, what? So you talk about bandits, right? You talk about the group called Boko Haram is actually the semi-organized terrorist group. They're more... I don't know a good analogy. We don't, it would almost be like some of the terrorist groups in the U.S. that are not so much organized as self-forming. And then there was some evidence that at least funding or support was coming in. Boko Haram is primarily a Muslim group, but that's more felt to be because of where they're from than, you know, the things we've been talking about. It's because of the economic disparity. It's because of that. So again, the Nigerians have been saying over and over again for the past 24 hours, it's not a religious issue. And the U.S. has been completely ignoring that and saying, Christian, 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 Christian. And I think that's a big difference.
Kieran wrote in to panel at WAMC.org and says, as similar to what Jim said earlier, I'm not opposed to Trump's strikes against ISIS, but it's interesting to see this administration frame ISIS and really all radical Islamist groups as solely anti-Christian. ISIS is a group that targets Muslims, Jews, Christians, Hindus, and everyone in between with equal vitriol. This doesn't need to turn into Trump's crusadist rally against Islam. And then to what we were just speaking about, Diane writes it and says the U.S. and whatever country is involved need to coordinate their narrative. It's my understanding from the coverage that Nigerian leadership thought they had agreed on a narrative, and perhaps even Marco Rubio did agree to that narrative, but then President Trump and Secretary of Defense Hegseth went off on social media, which is where all official business happens in the United States now. She said, with much chagrin, in their own narrative, and now they're picking up the pieces this morning, sort of.
Well, I think the Nigerian president, Bola Tinubu, is frustrated at the narrative that his country is allowing religious strife between Muslims and Christians, because he believes, and I'm not familiar enough, but he believes that its country actually protects religious diversity. And there are many other religions and groups and subgroups within the country. And so I think for him, where he is asking for support in helping reduce these bandits, the kidnappings that we've heard about in the news, where bandits will kidnap, 100 children from a school in order to extract some payout from the government or from religious groups. He's asking for help with that, and our country is saying, well, we'll help, but not on that basis. And we're going to spin this other narrative on Christmas Day around Christianity. I think it's kind of offensive, but here we are.
Well, this is, and just reading from I think it was the Washington Post story, they say that Trump threatened to attack Nigeria earlier last month, writing on Truth Social, quote, "If the Nigerian government continues to allow the killing of Christians, the USA will immediately stop all aid and assistance to Nigeria and may very well go into that now disgraced country, guns a-blazing, to completely wipe out the Islamic terrorists who are committing these horrible atrocities." So that is not only not presidential, it also is not defining the problem properly. It whether it's misunderstanding or intentionally, for their own anti-Muslim purposes, misdefining what's going on there. And I think that part of the problem is that there are, it gets back to Pope Leo's message, right? There are a wide variety of ways to address the atrocities that are happening there. And probably an effective one would be what is called soft power. But Trump, and, he doesn't either understand or believe it. But you wonder, as you were talking, Nick, it made me think, what was the financial price tag for that strike? And I wonder if it exceeded the amount of USAID food funding that was cut from Nigeria. I mean, I don't know, but it just occurs to me. Like, it gets at this question of, where are they going with this? What is their philosophy? What is their governing philosophy? Just like, where are they going with what they're doing in Venezuela? Who was it that Colin Powell always said, before you do something, you have to say, ask yourself, and then what happens next? Right. Mm-hmm. And was the question, and what happens next, addressed here? And what are the downsides for Nigeria, for the U.S., for the globe, in misdefining what the problem is in Nigeria and creating a Muslim-Christian divide? I mean, it seems that it's the definition of not helpful.
I mean, I just fundamentally disagree with the notion that bombing people who are experiencing severe poverty is the Christian thing to do when there are Christians in the country dying of starvation at an exceptional rate. I mean, on the Global Hunger Index, Nigeria ranks 115th out of 123 countries. It is experiencing a severe shortage. Over 10% of children die before their fifth birthday from hunger. Over 11% of children under 5 are considered wasted, which is somebody who is actively starving. Mm-hmm. 33.8% under 5 are stunted, meaning they will not achieve their full growth potential because they haven't had enough nutrition in their early years. how are we saying that we're saving the lives of Christian people when we're cutting food but sending bombs?
Well, in Yemen, Gaza, Somalia, all of, you know, the Sudan, all of these places, you know, and that's the fundamental question of what is our role in the, you know, as ostensibly global leaders. And, you know, what is Russia doing there? What's China doing there? What's U.S. doing there? And to me, it gets back to what's Israel's purpose and how, what does it have to do with the potential exploitation of their oil and gas resources?
Well, not even just their oil. I mean, car manufacturers in the United States rely on Nigeria lead recycling, which is now research is coming out to show the impact
so
of the
dangerous.
Lead poisoning on those recycling facilities in the entire cities and towns. I won't call it the whole town where these centers are have lead poisoning rates at like five times the level considered poisoning in some of these children. So we're poisoning these towns. Now there's pressure to force the closure of those recycling centers, which will eliminate largely the only employment options available in those towns, while also experiencing global climate change, which is reducing the ability or impacting the ability of those farms to produce food. And the population is growing pretty quickly, actually. And so you have an exploding population, even more hunger and food scarcity, and a loss of industry because of, you know, global pressures around not poisoning children, right?
panel@wamc.org. Our panelists this morning, public policy and communications expert Teresa Bourgeois, Tetherless World Senior Constellation Professor of Computer Web and Cognitive Science at RPI, Jim Hendler, and Executive Director of the Legal Aid Society of Northeastern New York. You can join the conversation by emailing us, panel@wamc.org. Jim, hold on to that thought, and we do have some letters to read. We will return after news from the BBC. Welcome to the final portion of this morning's roundtable panel. I want to remind everybody that from 11 to noon, we will be airing A Season's Griot, our annual Kwanzaa celebration public radio special. That's on from 11 to noon today. Panel this morning, Teresa Bourgeois, Jim Hendler, and Nick Rangel. You can join the conversation by emailing us, panel@wamc.org, which is where we heard from Steve, who says, I think, you know, tongue-in-cheek, as it were, observation, funny how Trump doesn't care about the dire condition of Christians in Ukraine. That as relevant to the claim to care about Christian lives in Nigeria. We also heard from Joe, who says, where is the required authorization and notification to Congress for Trump's invasion into Africa, Eastern Europe, Central and South America, and the Middle East? Oh, I forgot. Congress is on vacation. This from Joe. Feels like World War III to me.
Put panel, that question to Republican House members, please, folks.
panel@wamc.org. Gary says, part of the Declaration of Independence is religious freedom. If we're attacking Nigeria on religious values, aren't we ignoring our own country's belief? Indeed. Jim, you had something to say before the break, and I've added these letters to expand the conversation. Please continue.
It gets into a lot of international politics and things like that. But
it does.
There was a book that came out in the first Trump administration called Making China Great Again, about how U.S. creating vacuums in a number of parts of the world were allowing China to move in. And China was not moving in with military force. It was moving in primarily with economic opportunities, creating things. I heard a recent podcast with the author of the book who says he could never have imagined how much the second Trump administration would do that, that cutting U.S. aid was essentially the best thing this country could possibly do for China. It literally handed the entire southern part of Africa to China. It literally hands most of the Southeast Asian countries, many of whom were not particularly favorable to China, who are now dependent on it because the U.S. took off their counter balances. And, you know, it's somewhat scary, not so much as I've never really been so worried about the fact that we're going to go to war with China, we're going to go to war with Russia, although God forbid that should ever happen because that's the end of all of us. But the ability of the U.S. to have international capabilities, to have the influence to do the things we've had, to be a leading country, is hurt every time we do that. And, you know, I think it's been said a lot about the new so-called Trump doctrine, that essentially it's viewing the world as divided up into roughly three parts with three superpowers, and we own our North and South America, and we're not going to worry so much about anywhere else, although we're bombing Nigeria. That, you know, the Russians kind of get to control their part of the world and the Chinese get to theirs. And, you know, I could imagine a world where that would be a peaceful and good thing, but that's not the way it's being viewed here. And it puts us at tremendous risk because many of these countries supply things we need. And now those supply lines are controlled by countries that are not our geopolitical allies. And I think that, you know, really puts us in a interesting and negative situation because, you know, again, we could see a situation where we want to take some kind of action on China. We've already seen this playing out in the small. We take some kind of thing. We say we're adding these tariffs to China. China comes back and says, okay, we will no longer ship such and such to the U.S. through this other port. And the U.S. is forced to back down because we've allowed ourselves to get into a position of weakness with respect to some of these things. And many of these things are things that could actually cause great harm to our country. Should it become essentially a really hostile situation? So the hypothesis is that by focusing on this, you know, make America great again, isolationism, which has been a call from many conservative Republican groups, but now has been taken to a much, much stronger stance by this administration, really is something that people in America don't really engage with. We don't really think a lot about our relationships with the rest of the world and just how important that is. And I think that's going to come back and I have a phrase I want to use, but the red button's here. It's going to bite us in a part of the anatomy that we would prefer not to be bitten in.
But I think China has long taken, you know, the long and the broad view of things, and certainly the U.S. in general, but this administration in particular does not do the same. And that's why that China, in terms of, say, rare earths, for example, which are key for technology and innovation and such, and they have for a very long time been working to really control the market in rare earths. And now Trump is trying to catch up in ways that I don't think are that helpful, understanding the urgency of it, but going at it in a way that I don't think is very helpful. And I think a lot of his Ukraine policy is focused on taking control of Ukraine's rare earth materials. I think that's a lot of, you know, Russia certainly has that in mind. But China, the way that China has taken control of these areas and these resources is not, they're not bombing anybody. They're not sending in any military. They're building roads. They're building ports. They're
roads
building, you know, roads and bridges and infrastructure, as you say, and it's a very different approach. And they are not going in and trying to create internal divisions or creating internal divisions in their own country. And in any case, I think this is, I just think, again, more broadly, the hollowing out, the eliminating of the Institute for Peace, the eliminating of the USAID, the hollowing out of our State Department, all make us less, not more safe.
I do want to add, though, that while it is true that China is investing in industry developments in countries like Nigeria, it is largely based on debt, and the debt carried by Nigeria that it owes to China is between $5 and $9.6 billion right now. And we know historically that when countries have that level of debt to a larger country, that eventually that country comes and expects to get paid. And that those expectations lead to austerity measures that really exasperate both the control that the country has over its resources, but also the poverty levels and poverty rates in those countries. So as the U.S. is ceding land, essentially, and soft power to China, to Russia, by exiting the field, removing that aid, reducing our influence in those countries are then additionally destabilized by the level of debt that they end up having to take on in order to just stay afloat while they, you know, pivot, I guess, away from U.S. support. We also know with the rare earth and other minerals that is, we're kind of backing out of Africa, but now we're trying to take Greenland so that we have another resource. Right. And it is, as I started the conversation, our government is kind of an agent of chaos right now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's, yes. I think it's exploitive, not philanthropic, what China's doing. Yeah, I didn't mean to suggest what China's doing is philanthropic, but they're doing it in a different way. They're not coming in and spending a couple million dollars dropping a weapon. They are, it's a much longer, different approach.
Right. And Nick, I think the thing that, when you look at national security, worries people about the Chinese approach is exactly that kind of debt situation,
right,
which can be exploited not simply by saying, hey, we're going to take over, we're going to exploit you economically, but rather, hey, we want you to close this port. We want you to stop exporting this to that country. Right, so the ability to destroy supply lines, the ability to create food insecurity, the ability to really significantly impact the U.S. by exploiting that economic control, not to mention the amount of investment China has in the U.S. that could also be used as a, not so much a weapon, but as a bargaining point. I mean, you know, you'll notice every time Trump pushes things up on China, he's forced to push them back down again. And that's because the U.S. is largely dependent on a lot of things that are either made in China, come through China, have supply lines that go through places supported by China, et cetera. And if, you know, nobody has an exact world map of it, but the maps that have been developed really show you the U.S. dependency on a lot of these things. And we just keep saying, well, we're self-dependent, we don't need any of these things, et cetera, et cetera.
Well, I think
that's just not true.
Isn't that why President Biden's administration, they were trying to reshore key manufacturing and build up key resources that were acquired in the U.S. so that we were not as dependent?
Yes.
And much of that, the Trump administration has disassembled, and particularly around clean energy and then what he's doing with chips. But
chips and
science. I digress.
Yeah.
I digress.
Well, I mean, you know.
Well, again, the way they're tearing apart our science. Well, you know better than me on right. The science.
Well, you know, and my friends in China who are at universities have seen their funding raised, and we've seen our funding cut. And we're talking about, you know, the U.S. is saying we can't regulate AI because we want to be able to, quote, keep our lead on China. We can argue over whether we have a lead on China, but I can tell you that without the money being invested in longer-term research, which China is doing, in areas like AI, quantum, and other emerging technologies, as well as traditional technologies, recyclables and renewable power, we're just going to fall way behind. And we're going to look like some of the countries did in the aftermath of World War II without necessarily needing the war.
Well, this Trump administration attack on our universities, and this is why, you know, Elise Stefanik, I never understood how she thought she could run for, you know, succeed as a governor, given that our state
is... And she was hoping for some support from higher up that she did not get, and now she's out.
Well, I don't know that would have helped her, but you know, her and I guess she has a book coming out about it. But you know, we're a state that, you know, universities are core to our economic engine as they drive innovation, and why the Trump administration and people like Congresswoman Stefanik think attacking our, you know, universities and going after university-based research and then, you know, reducing access to students and cutting student loans and all of that, to me, that's a tremendous economic mistake. I mean, you want to invest in human capital, and which is what drives innovation, not disinvest, but it's all part of an approach. It's interesting to me to see this as kind of an aside, but so much of this came out of the Heritage Foundation, and you see over the last week the splitting apart of the Heritage Foundation and former Vice President Pence creating his own separate group that's pulling like half of the Heritage Foundation leaving and going to his group.
What is his group called?
I can't remember the name, but thank you for busily looking it up for me. But so much of this, you know, the Project 2025...
Advancing American Freedom.
There we go, whatever that is. But it's interesting to see that this split that's occurring and where that will go. But a lot of what's being implemented by Russ Fode and Vance and others is really what came out of Project 2025 out of the Heritage Foundation, which is pulled together an umbrella group. But this is all part of a piece, and I don't know how they really believe, particularly the attack on our university-based research, how that's going to help our economy. It seems to me it's going to do the opposite.
Nick? Panel at W.
That was a windy.
Yeah.
Yeah, we're like,
sorry.
Those of us on the radio can't see Nick's face.
So where did Teresa go? I'm sorry. And in the back of my mind, I'm just thinking, is there anything positive we can talk about? It's the day after Christmas. This is all so gloomy, too. Like, no, I can't think of anything.
I can't think of anything.
I'm doing the weave. Sorry.
It's okay.
The Trump weave.
Oh, my God.
And then I was also thinking about eviction. You said earlier about eviction. There's a book that people should read about eviction and how destabilizing it is for individuals and communities. Matthew Desmond, Evicted, Poverty and Profit. Poverty and Profit in the American City. As we're talking about housing, that was a good book if people want to learn more.
Well, on a potentially positive note, and I'm keeping potentially in there with it underlined five or six times, is Zelensky will be meeting with Trump.
Breaking news this morning, yes.
Yeah, he's coming on Sunday. And there's reason to believe that some of the current agreements that Russia has said no to some of what Trump wants, right, which mm-hmm. I think surprised Trump.
Yeah.
And then Ukraine is not saying yes, but Ukraine is saying we can negotiate. And so I think, you know, will we see a breakthrough right away? No, but I think it's a hopeful sign that we've gone from Trump insulting Zelensky and saying horrible things to
him. I don't think we can count on that at all. But right.
But it's moving to where now it may become a three-way negotiation rather than a two-way negotiation and telling Zelensky what's going to happen. But we'll see what happens. At the moment,
it was interesting to me. They were talking about possibly creating this essentially a DMZ.
Demilitarized zone.
Demilitarized zone.
It's okay.
So that raises the obvious question of who would control it. But Zelensky, I was reading earlier today, and it might have changed again since 7 o'clock this morning, but was saying, yes, well, you know, we would want that to go to a vote of the public. Because remember, a week or two ago, Trump said, well, Zelensky was due to have elections, that they, you know, he needed to stand for election. So he's now saying, okay, let's have an election. Let's have a vote over this idea of, do we want to create this DMZ? So I thought that that was a very clever strategic move on a part of Zelensky to say, yes, we'll consider this, but let the people vote on it. But I think this is where, with the Trump administration, okay, how's that exactly going to work? Who's going to actually do that? Who's going to pay for it? Who are going to be the the people who are protecting that DMZ? And are you going to send U.S. soldiers there? And at what cost? And then is it where it happened to be where the rare earths are? And because they called it an economic DMZ. So who's going to control that? I think there's so many questions. It's like, I mean, this is going to sound like a weave, but Trump RX, I've been trying to get it, you know, where there's prescription drugs and you can just go directly to the Trump RX to get your prescription drugs. Okay, what exactly is that? Who's controlling it? Who is running it? Who's selling the drugs? I mean, there's a lot of
Shady operations. Shady is the word I said, S-H-A-D-Y, in case it sounded like something else.
But it just all of these, like what's the detail behind it? You know, we're going to eliminate FEMA, I'm thinking about the people in California today, and we're going to send it back to the states and it'll all work. Well, how is that going to work?
Panel is over. I'm not actually going to say the email address again, but I will on Monday when we return after the weekend. This morning's panel, Teresa Bourgeois, Jim Hendler, and Nick Rangel. Thank you all as ever for being here, and, you know, Happy New Year.
Happy New Year.
You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.